This is a download from the Scottish Railway Preservation Society.
Just putting some lights on the engine now. We've got two lights showing it's a passenger train.
This is Soundbox, a magazine for railway enthusiasts around the world, coming to you from Bowness in Scotland.
Hello and welcome to this, the 22nd edition of Soundblast, the Scottish Railway Preservation Society's download, the totally non-visual magazine. I'm Sandy Simpson, and I'm standing beside the indefatigable David Bytheway, the editor, producer and roving reporter for Soundblast. You join us in Bowness on the 9th of September 2012, which is Vintage Carriages Day on the Bowness and Kinneil Railway for railway buffs, the day of the Bowness Speed Climb for sports car enthusiasts, and just 2 days after the unveiling of the splendid replica of the Bridgeness Slab, barely a mile away from where we are now, commemorating the Roman legionaries' completion of the Antonine Wall the better part of 2,000 years ago. But the train is waiting to go, so we must get on board quickly.
Thank you, gentlemen.
That's us leaving Bowness. We are on board a train of three all teak finished LNER or XLNER design carriages, and we're passing the two restored Caledonian Railway coaches which are sitting in the bay platform having just come in from Birkhill. So we'll get more on the details of these three coaches. There's a Thompson designed open second in front of us, open third I suppose when he designed it. We're travelling in a genuine Gresley buffet car of genuine wood teak, and bringing up the rear of the train is one of these multi-purpose coaches that Thompson designed for small branch services. It'll be a first, third, composite, non-corridor vehicle. But more on these in a few minutes' time. Well, now we're on the service to Birkhill. We are actually travelling in an LNER Gresley buffet car. It was built in 1937 and is number 644 to the LNER. So it's as old as I am, but it's looking in much better nick. And one of the men responsible for that is joining us now. It's Don Clark. Don, tell us about the restoration of this carriage.
Well, when I first started here in 1997, I think it was, this vehicle was just an absolute bare skeleton. It still had the original framing, but all the outside teak planking had been taken off. The inside was completely stripped. It was just a bare shell from end to end. And we've built it all back up from that. One of the more interesting aspects of it is the planking on the outside, which is teak. It came from Burma on a ship called the SS Pegu, which was plying between Liverpool and Rangoon in 1917 during the First World War. And as it was coming back into Liverpool, it was torpedoed and sank. Divers found it 75 years later. They looked in the hold to see what was in it. It should have been rice. The fish had eaten all the rice. So they went to Lloyd's of London to find out what was manifested on the boat, and it was rice. But there were all these huge logs in the bottom of the hold.
As ballast?
As the captain smuggling.
Ah!
So right. The Ministry of Defence were informed what these were, teak logs, 20 feet long, 2 feet square. So the Ministry of Defence salvaged the whole lot, kept half of it for themselves for repairing things like HMS Victory at Portsmouth, and the other half was sold to the LNER Coach Association. And the planking from this vehicle, in this vehicle, is from one of those logs.
Well, well.
And the wood is absolutely amazing. It's like it was cut yesterday. It's absolutely beautiful.
I'm hugely impressed by the paintwork on the exterior of this carriage, which is absolutely gorgeous. It's in the Packard proper LMER 1937 livery, with its lining ending in the, what I would call, arrowheads. I don't know what you call them. Who was responsible for the painted work?
Dave Simpson did most of the outside work, but most of the lining, especially the arrowheads, was done by a gentleman who's quite close to me, Mr. Jim Summers, right behind me.
And I dare say we'll get a word with Jim Summers in a few minutes' time. And the interior, it's got a very genuine LMER look to it, but you see it was stripped completely when the SRPS...
Absolutely, completely. It was totally devoid of any panelling, nothing.
Are they chromium or stainless steel frame chairs, are they?
These are stainless steel replica chairs.
They're replica. The tables likewise?
Half the tables are original. The tops had to be replaced because they were all scuffed and chewed up.
Yes.
But we still have one of the original chairs. The chairs were stored at Banbeath when we moved from Falkirk to Bowness. And because of the construction, which was steel frame with chrome on them, they got rusty. They got covered in sheep and pigeon. And just generally rotted away, so we had to make the decision to change the whole lot, so we had these specially made.
And the buffet counter, which has got a lovely look to it, is that again a replica?
That's a replica, I built that.
You
I'm
built
glad to see it. Yep.
I've got a job for you in my house, I can tell you. Now, were you working from original LMER drawings?
Yes, yes we did. The original drawings came from the National Railway Museum in York, and we have a couple of copies. It's just a general assembly, that's the best expression.
Don Clark, thank you very much indeed, and congratulations on the quality of the work. It's gorgeous. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Don mentioned Jim Summers and gave him credit, and well due credit it is too, for having painted part of the exterior of this coach. I'm now with Jim Summers, and Jim's going to tell us, I hope, about the joys of doing the Gresley-style lining out on this buffet.
Well, my particular concern has been the arrowheads, and I simply do not know how many there are. It was completely demotivating if I counted up how many there were to do. But it must run into the 60 or 70. And it's quite a long process because there's two colours involved and different sides, and one way and another. Simply to do one arrowhead takes about 3 weeks with all the drying that's involved.
Now, this is an 8-window coach, so there'll be arrowheads either side of every window panel, which I think makes 64 for starters, and the top and bottom.
Depressing,
lining,
isn't it?
So it'll be 128, and there could be the odd extra one or two here or there. 128. How many weeks to do one?
Well, you have to do it in a sequence to let paint dry, but it's about 3 weeks in stages for each individual one.
Good heavens. Well, that's a lifetime of work, just about.
Yes.
And we've arrived in Birkhill, which gives us the opportunity to get off and admire your work. Jim Summers, thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we're stationary in Birkhill now, which is how we've managed to stagger as far as the bar. Where we are, we were hoping to get hold of some Flying Scotsman ale, but I think we're going to be disappointed, bartender.
I'm afraid we've sold all the Flying Scotsman. It's been very popular today.
And the bartender is Ian Butcher. So, Ian, what can we have?
Well, we have Ben Nevis and Jukos.
Jukos for me. And for you, David?
And for me, please.
Two Jukos, please.
£6.
And I might add, there are no electronic tills on this train. And we're stationary now in Birkhill, and David and I are about to enjoy our Jugger's India Pale Ale. We'll be back in a few minutes and we'll tell you about the other coaches which make up this three-coach LNER train.
Well, that's us just on our way out of Burkhill, on our return journey to Bowness. And next door to the buffet car in which we are sitting is Eleanor Thompson, third class tourist open coach number 13803. Sir Nigel Gresley died in office in 1941 and was succeeded as chief mechanical engineer by Edward Thompson, whose name is associated with post-war Eleanor carriage construction. In two key respects, 13803 represents the new order. It is laid out as an open saloon rather than with traditional compartments, and its body is made of steel panels screwed to a timber frame. The new carriages, when they were new that is, in 1947, was painted to resemble wood, and that's the livery which this coach carries now. And the third vehicle in the train is an Eleanor Thompson design brake composite coach number SC80417E. It's clearly Thompson Eleanor carriage in concept, but the first coaches were not built until 1951, when 41 were built for the Scottish region of British Railways. While post-war carriage design favoured all steel bodies, material shortages dictated what was practicable, and this body has a wooden frame and steel sheet sides. Built by R.Y. Pickering at Wishaw in Lancashire, this coach is one of the last products of the Scottish railway coach building industry. And we are now approaching the live with point where the line crosses the Antonine Wall. Well, that's the truth of the matter, but it's rather better fun to suggest that the high bridge was provided by the Romans in anticipation of the arrival of the railway some century, two millennia later. The second legion who built this last section of the Antonine Wall put up a special tablet which details that they had built 4,652 pieces of wall. The tablet, it's about 6 feet long by 2 feet wide, was lost in the mists of history, rediscovered about 100 years ago, and presented to a museum in Edinburgh, which was to become the National Museum of Scotland, where it's still on display. But the local community had something to celebrate this week, when an exact replica of the Bridgeness slab, as it is now, was unveiled not far from where the wall ended. David, by the way, was there as Madeline Hunt of Bowness Community Council unveiled the stone.
I'd now like to hand the stone over to the people of Bowness and ask them to keep it like it is and enjoy it, and I hope it brings lots of people to your town. Thank you.
And with those words, the new Bridgeness slab was unveiled. The original slab was found not far away, as local councillor Adrian Mahoney explains.
The Bridgeness slab, of course, was found not far from here in 1868 on land owned by the Caddell family. It was put into the care of the museum in Edinburgh, now the National Museum of Scotland, and you can go and see the original on show in Chambers Street. There's been a strong desire from the community council for about 10 years to have a proper replica put in place here in Bowness. Of course, there's a small copy of the Latin text down Harbour Road, but they wanted something to really show local people the full extent of the slab, and so the project was started to actually recreate the Bridgeness slab. And then there was a copying of the slab itself. The slab, of course, is installed in the National Museum of Scotland. It's nearly 2,000 years old, and it has traces of Roman paint on it. So the museum said, we don't really want you to take a cast of the original slab, but you could do a laser copy. So they actually use lasers to actually scan the slab in situ, and then copy that, and then use milling, a computer-controlled milling machine, to actually cut it into a new piece of sandstone.
With me now is Colin Muir, who was responsible for scanning the digital image of the stone. Now, Colin, it was quite a project, wasn't it? Because the actual location of the stone presented some problems.
Yes, there were logistical issues that we needed to consider quite carefully. Because the stone is fairly large, and it's also about 6 feet off the ground, and it's in a very publicly accessible part of the gallery, it meant that it wasn't something we could digitise during the day. So we had to make arrangements to scan it overnight. So my colleague Alan McKenzie and myself were able to have our own midnight in the museum, as it were. So we arrived at 5 o'clock after everyone was leaving the museum and started to set up our equipment. And we were scanning through the night until I think we finally left about 6 in the morning. So we'd got all the data we needed by that stage.
How actually do you do it?
The process that we used was a triangulation scanner. It's set up on a tripod, which is then moved to take a shot, and moved slightly again to take an adjoining shot. You need to ensure that there's an overlap between these, and each shot captures a three-dimensional image of the surface. These are then manually stitched together within the software to form a mosaic of the object in three dimensions, and these are all then finally merged into a fully complete model.
And after that, you handed over to the stonemasons.
Yeah, so it wasn't, again, quite as straightforward as that. We hoped it would be, but we ended up with a three-dimensional model, which was something in the region of 1.8 gigabytes. And when we suggested that we send this to the CNC milling machine, they just about had a heart attack. That's not really the file size that they were looking for. So we eventually managed to decimate our file sizes down to a point that the machinery could actually take it. So I think it ended up about 300 megabytes.
Is this as good as the real thing, the stone, or have you actually made any improvements to it?
I think that the final result is extraordinary. It's the first time that we've used this process from scanning and handing it on to CNC milling.
But with computers, you have the opportunity to tweak things. If there's a blemish on the original, did you keep the blemish or did you improve it?
No, absolutely. Any blemishes were kept. This wasn't about trying to return the stone to how it may have been. This is purely about replicating every single element of that surface, because that's the story within that surface is really its history.
I just asked Jess Bailey, the keeper of archaeology and local history for Falkirk Community Trust, to give a little brief history of the slab.
Well, as you can see, it's a really monumental piece of art, and 9 feet long, with a central inscription which basically tells you who built Dantenang Wall, why Dantenang Wall was built. It's built by legionaries. It's the largest Roman inscription in northern Britain. You know, it is of national importance. So it's not just the local community who've done a magnificent job of reproducing it. It's significant worldwide. It marks the zenith of the Roman Empire at a time when they were constructing a frontier which was at the cutting point of technology. The inscription itself, and I'm sure you can all read this, so if you follow it with me, Imperial Caesar Titus Aurelius Hadrianus Antoninus Augustan Pius, the father of his country, Propatria, the second August Legion, made, that's the fecit, and it gives you the distance, which is approximately 4 miles, which is the distance from here to the river.
And I'm joined again, this time on the platform at Bowness Station, by Jim Summers, because David and I are about to board a train made of two Caledonian railway carriages, and Jim can tell us a little bit about them.
Well, the Caledonian carriages, of course, are very colourful. You're immediately struck by the two-tone livery, and the more you look at it, again, there's more detailed lining, and really they're very elegant vehicles, but we're lucky with these ones because the Caledonian Railway had actually ceased to be when these were delivered from the builders. The Caledonian Railway was just about the last to get roped into the big LMS grouping, and these carriages had not yet been delivered, and when they were, everyone was delighted to find they were delivered in that beautiful two-tone livery.
Indeed, indeed. What are the official names of the colours? Is it chocolate and white? What would you call the original official name?
Well, people argue a lot about chocolate, and they argue a lot about colour. But that was officially called a chocolate, but it's a sort of purpley-brown, really. People argue forever.
And they are all wood, presumably?
These are wooden carriages.
These are wooden carriages. Yes. And the build date?
1922.
Jim Summers, thank you very much indeed. We're going to board the train because it's now signalled. The guard is waiting with his green flag. So are we may.
Bon voyage.
Are you going all this time? Like
and we are now on board the Caledonian Railway train. Alas, we don't have a Caledonian Railway engine. The Society's Caledonian Railway engine, number 419, is currently being overhauled. So we have an engine that was built during the Second World War for the War Department, but it will serve the turn and we will enjoy travelling in a compartment carriage. Wow, nice bench seating here. Built, as you heard there, in 1922. So it's 90 years old. And we're about to go. David and I are on our way back up to Burke Hill, relaxing in the comfort of a compartment with its bench seating. No armrest, no intermediate armrest, perhaps I should say so. It probably intended to seat four aside. And I'm looking around the compartment and see things that, well, you wouldn't see today in a train. First of all, the door is marked third, a reminder of the fact that, of course, when these carriages were in their heyday, there was first class and third class of the Caledonian Railway. And also sandblasted into the window the word smoking, which you certainly would not find today. The carriages that we have on the train today are a third-class corridor compartment coach number 1375, which, for the true enthusiast, was Caledonian Diagram 124 and was built by the Metropolitan Carriage and Wagon Company in Birmingham. This carriage represents the very best of what the Scottish Railway Companies were providing at the end of their independent existence. It has eight third-class compartments, seating 64 people, and two lavatories, and ran on mainline services, such as those from Glasgow to Stirling, or Glasgow to Edinburgh via Carstairs. And the other vehicle in the train is to Caledonian Diagram 111A. It's number 464, and it was delivered in the final few months of the Caledonian's existence. It's a corridor composite, meaning it contains both first and third class compartments, has two lavatories, and a small break area for the guard and the luggage to comply with the Caledonian Railway practice of not allowing travel in compartments next to the locomotive for safety reasons. They're both painted, as Jim Summers told us, in the Caledonian Railway livery of, well, whatever it was, dark maroon is a good name for it, and white, lined and lettered in gold. But the interior of these coaches has never been altered or rebuilt, and they show exactly what mainline travel was like on the railway in Scotland in the 1920s and 1930s. It's time for Mike Yodelick to once again open his archive of historic steam recordings. Here's Mike.
Thanks, Sandy. Now it's 9:04 p.m. on the 22nd November 1966 at Cooper Station. Class B1460, 61029, named Shamwa, passes northbound with the 7:30 p.m. goods from Thornton to Dundee. Thank you. The following night, at 6:28 p.m. on the 23rd November 1966, Class B1460, number 61278, passes through Cooper Station travelling light engine, pushing a single brake van from Dundee to Thornton. It's 6:15 p.m. on 24th November 1966. The early evening passenger train from Broughty Ferry to Edinburgh comes to a halt in Cooper Station. After a shrill blast and a whistle, it departs under the road overbridge, its distinctive three-cylinder exhaust beats echoing into the night. V26836 pulls away from Cooper Station. And that's it for just now. See you next time.
And that pretty well wraps up this edition of Soundblast. You can contact us online at www.srps.org.uk/soundblast, all lowercase. That's www.srps.org.uk/soundblast. Or you can write to us at Soundblast, two words this time with initial capitals, Soundblast, SRPS, Union Street, Bowness, West Lothian, EH519AQ, Scotland. The tireless roving reporter, location manager, editor, producer, beer provider and publicist has been David Bytheway. And I'm Sandy Simpson, wishing you all that you wish yourself from everyone here at the Scottish Railway Preservation Society at Bowness in Scotland.